This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. World Lung Cancer Day was commemorated on the 1st of August, and it's a timely reminder that the number of lung cancer cases is still very high in Malaysia and that survival is poor despite advances in treatment. As we revisit this disease again, I'll be asking consultant oncologist Dr. John Lau why we cannot afford to stop talking about lung cancer. How are you today, Dr. John?
I'm good, Chucky.
Okay. Dr. John, let's start with some basics, right? Understanding the lungs and also then where does cancer develop in the lungs?
Okay. So lung cancer basically develops in the parenchyma itself, means inside the lung tissue itself in the airway. So it's a lining of the cells along the airway that became malignant because of some trigger, either environmentally insult. The most common, of course, is smoking, but there will be a lot of other environmental agents that can actually be carcinogenic, even radon gas that can be in the natural environment and also in houses with poor ventilation and all that. Mm-hmm. Various car exhaust, industrial chemicals and waste, and all this could be potential source of as a carcinogen. Not just cigarette smoking. And all this can cause the change in the cell, in the lining of the lung tissue that can then predispose them to mutate and then turn cancerous.
All right. I understand there are different types of lung cancer. There's non-small cell and there's small cell. And to be honest, I always find it very difficult to distinguish and to understand the differences. What exactly do these small and non-small cells refer to?
So these are actually the appearance of the cell under the microscope. So when the pathologist, because a diagnosis of cancer is not made on the scans. So when you look at a CT scan or an X-ray, we are actually just seeing a shadow. All right. And that shadow could be anything. It could be an infection or some other source of rather than cancer. Mm-hmm. So you need to take a tissue biopsy, and then when you take a tissue biopsy, the pathologist will look at it under the microscope, and then they will stain for those cells to look at them, what they are, whether it's truly a cancer or it's something else. And then the appearance of the cell tells us what kind of tissue or cancer we are dealing with. So basically, for the longest time, we have differentiated two types of the most common type of cells, which is the small cell lung cancer and the non-small cell. So these two very broad category. So the small cell lung cancer, basically, as its name suggests, they are small little cells. Okay, and it's stained blue in color. And when you look under the scans, under the microscope, and they are usually very, very aggressive. And those are the kind of cancer that smokers tend to develop. So it's usually in the central part of the chest, and it constitutes probably about 10-15% of the total cancer burden. But a majority of the cancer cells that we are seeing now are the non-small cell lung cancer. Probably 80-90% of cancers are non-small cell.
And if you say small cell cancer is typically seen among smokers, but it contributes 10-15%, whereas who do you typically see non-small cell cancers among then? What kinds of populations?
Okay. So when I say typically seen in small cell lung cancer, what I meant is that it usually exclusively happens in patients who smoke. So non-smoker hardly will get small cell lung cancer. That's what I meant, yeah.
I see, okay. Yeah. But coming back then to the causes of lung cancer, smoking is still the main contributor then?
Absolutely. Smoking is still the number one cause for lung cancer. Mm-hmm. So we know that there are a lot of carcinogens within the content of the cigarette, beside nicotine and all that, tar and a lot of various other chemicals in the cigarette smoke can lead to lung cancer. So it's still the number one cause of lung cancer.
What about secondhand smoke? How much does that contribute to the burden of lung cancer?
So that it's hard to quantify, you know, but we do know that there are a lot of studies have shown that secondhand smoke is as well contributes to lung cancer. And so these are based on a lot of epidemiological studies. So we know that it is the same thing, whether you take it firsthand or secondhand, a carcinogen is a carcinogen. So all this legislation of cutting down the exposure to the public, you know, or non-smoking public, I think it's very, very important.
You're talking about things like the smoking ban that was introduced in public eateries. That
yes,
would have been
correct.
Last year, wasn't it? So
yes.
Do you foresee this having an impact on smoking behaviors and ultimately to reduce lung cancer numbers?
Oh, I do hope so. You know, because we know that non-smoking is the number one cause, and secondhand smoke as well. So if we can cut that down, the exposure to the non-smoking public, and especially, you know, younger adults and even kids and all that, I think, you know, that the carcinogenic effect of smoking, it doesn't happen overnight. You know, it's a prolonged kind of exposure. So it takes the effort to be done as soon as possible to cut down the exposure. And I'm sure, time will tell, definitely, that the incidence and the prevalence of lung cancer will hopefully diminish or lessen because of the effort that was put in.
Yeah, but you know, Dr. John, we've been talking about the link between smoking and lung cancer for years, for decades now, right? So we can't say that the awareness is not there, but the number of new cases, if we look worldwide every year, it increased in 2012 from 1.8 million to 2.09 million in 2018. That's worldwide. So why do you think there's this disconnect between the awareness about the risk of smoking and the lung cancer numbers? Is there something that we're not seeing?
Yeah. So despite all the campaigns and all that, we also know that the number of smokers are not diminishing. They're actually increasing. And especially in the developing world, it's actually very, very alarming, the number of smokers that we have, and even younger adults and females. So it's not surprising that the incidence of lung cancer is actually increasing rather than diminishing. So, I mean, is it, why is that so? Is it because, patient just doesn't believe that smoking causes lung cancer? But I think the awareness campaign is probably not wide enough, especially in those developing countries. Mm-hmm. And, it's still seen as a symbol sometimes in some places, as it's being a macho symbol, or some patient can that they can also be a form of like even stressful society and all that. They see smoking as a form of relaxation, and also a lot of times, young kids and impressionable teenagers, they get influenced by adults and also by advertisement and all that, which I think is still a very strong industry there, so when all this impetus are still there, it's very hard for us to really stop people from smoking. So I think that's probably the reason why the incidents are still increasing. And of course, the environmental pollution and all those things are not helping. So we are also seeing cases going up because of all this.
So what about here in Malaysia? What kind of incidents are we seeing? And is there any positive trend at all?
Well, I mean, in Malaysia as well as in everywhere else in the world, lung cancer remains one of the top cancer. Mm-hmm. So we are not spared from this. In fact, lung cancer is the second most cancer in the Malaysian males and the fifth most common cancer in Malaysian female. And the problem, not just the prevalence of the disease, but also a huge number, majority of our patients in Malaysia, they present with advanced stages. In fact, 90% of them detected at late stages. And that's the reason why the poorer outcome because of this.
Why do they present so late?
I think it's many, many reasons. One of it is that the symptom for lung cancer can be very non-specific. What it means is that, you know, you can present with just a cough, you know, or sometimes some phlegm and all that, which a lot of people will attribute it to, some infection or viral infection and all that, and they will tend to ignore the symptoms. And sometimes in very early stages as well, the lung cancer actually has no symptom, you know, and only when it comes more advanced and when the lymph nodes are affected or when they invade into certain surrounding structures in the lung before they really have symptoms like cough, chest pain, or even coughing out blood and all that. So that's the reason why it tends to present stage 3 and stage 4.
All right. So then let's go for a quick break now. And when we come back, Dr. John, I want to ask you, is early detection possible then? I mean, is there something we can do to prompt screening, especially among high-risk groups? I'm speaking to consultant oncologist Dr. John Lau in conjunction with World Lung Cancer Day, which fell on the 1st of August. And of course, we're discussing the increasing incidence of lung cancer amidst high rates of smoking and why we need to keep talking about reducing the risk and preventing lung cancer. So we'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik. On the line with me is consultant oncologist Dr. John Lau. In conjunction with World Lung Cancer Day, which was commemorated on the 1st of August, we're talking, of course, about lung cancer. It's, I think, a timely reminder for all of us that lung cancer is still among the top 10 cancers among men and women in Malaysia, number 2 among males, and number 5 among females in Malaysia. Smoking is still the number one cause. And even secondhand smoke is considered a risk factor because the chemicals that are produced from cigarette smoke are carcinogenic. And another alarming statistic to be shared here is that 90% of lung cancer cases in Malaysia are diagnosed at the late stages. And so, Dr. John, before the break, you mentioned that one of the factors for late diagnosis is the fact that the symptoms are either very general or patients may not have symptoms at all. But is there any way to look out for risk factors, perhaps? And of course, smoking is the main risk factor. Is there any way to use that to prompt screening? Are there screening tests that we can use?
Yep. So we have studies confirming that if we actively screen those patients who are a high risk, we can actually detect the cancer at an earlier stage and therefore increase the chances of cure. So these are patients who normally they are smokers. So probably the longer they are, probably about 10, 15 years smoking history, many pack years, and family history, i.e. patients with history of lung cancer, even other cancers. And all these are some indicators that they should actually come forward for screening. Mm-hmm. And what we do is that the most active screening detection is what we call a low-dose CT scan. So these are CT scans that actually have very low radiation doses. And the studies have shown that they actually can pick up early cancers in this high-risk population and therefore cutting down on the late presentation and increasing cure.
All right.
So this is one way. Yeah.
Okay. One way. Are there other methods?
Well, the other thing is to be very vigilant, especially if you are a smoker. If you have symptoms that is unusual, you get persistent cough that is not the usual kind of cough that you have. Those smoker cough, they call it, and you have chest pain or coughing out blood, any signs that's not right, you have to straight away see someone. Even those that are not smokers, anything that persists for more than 2 weeks, any cough that persists for more than 2 weeks, chest pain that, is persistent, don't attribute it to just a common cold, or some muscle strain and all that. It should go forward and see the doctor and get it sorted out. So don't ignore your symptoms, and that's one way to make sure that we don't miss anything.
And coming back to the low dose CT scan for screening, what's the protocol for screening? Assuming I am a high-risk patient. For instance, I have many years of smoking history. I smoke, a high number of packs over those years. At what age should I begin screening, and how often should I be doing it?
So this is, again, a very controversial topic, because there are many different guidelines. So you can refer to the guideline, for example, from the Disease Prevention Center from the United States. And there are different guidelines at by different countries. You know, so that's, in terms of the state, the age of screening, that's not so vital as in how many years the patient has been exposed to smoking, as well as the family risk factors, etc. So I think the screening wise, it's not for the general public, definitely, because we really do not know, and the pickup rate will be very low for the general public. So you don't have a cutoff age as in I'm 50 years old, therefore I go for the screening. So I think more importantly is the risk profile of the patient. Those are the ones that actually should come forward for the screening.
Right, at any point, if they are smoking so much, and if they already have a family history, there's no time to waste to get to a certain age, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, you said active screening could potentially cure. What does a cure mean here?
So when it comes to lung cancer, especially non-small cell lung cancer, which is the majority of the cancer that we are seeing, the cure basically is surgery. So surgery is still the most important curative treatment for lung cancer. And surgery is only possible if you detect them at an early stage, let's say stage 1, stage 2, and very selected stage 3 diseases. Sometimes you can cure them with surgery. So that's why screening, detecting early, you can potentially cure the patient.
What exactly would the outcome be in terms of survival then?
So the survival, again, depends very much on which center you go to in terms of the expertise and all that. So, but in terms of survival, when you talk about stage 1, it's again a different kind of a range, but it can range anything from 60 to 80% chance of cure. When you have a stage 2, probably about 60, 70, or even 50%, depending on where you are and all that, you know, what kind of treatment that was received. Mm-hmm. And then stage 3, when it comes to stage 3, that's where it really drops significantly. So you're talking about, at best, you get about a 30, 40% chance of cure. Mm-hmm. But when you come to stage 3C and 3B, it's probably about 15% chance or even lower. And then when you come to stage 4, it's usually not curable. You're talking about probably a 5% chance of a 5-year survivor. You know, I mean, that is the general kind of trend. But of course, we know that with the significant improvement in these past years, we know that we can actually significantly improve the survival even in advanced cancer.
All right. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? What have these advances been?
I think there are a lot of advances, but whether it be surgery or radiotherapy. So in the early stages, of course, surgical techniques has improved. Nowadays, you can do minimally invasive surgery, keyhole operations, so patient recovery is faster, and the risk of complications are lower. And of course, for radiotherapy, which is the other modality that we can use to cure lung cancer, early stage lung cancer as well. Patients who are not medically fit for surgery or patients who refuse surgery, radiotherapy is an equally effective treatment for cure, even stage 1 cancer. So precise, focus, high doses of radiation that's targeted to the cancer, we call SBRT, is another recent advancement in the treatment of early disease. And then when it comes to the late stages, so we have our conventional chemotherapy, but now I would say that the major advance that is described as a game changer is immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. And we have seen remarkable results using this drug, this class of drug called the checkpoint inhibitors. which is a form of immunotherapy. And we have seen prolonged and also survival and disease control for many, many years in very advanced disease. And it's just a very, very exciting time in lung cancer because of this.
But you said earlier that stage four is not curable. How much has immunotherapy changed that outlook then?
So basically, we know that stage four disease, stage four solid cancers like lung cancers, you know, it's incurable. Okay, mm-hmm. But we have seen remarkable results with immunotherapy because based on some of the studies that has been published so far, we have survivals up to 5 years or more of up to about 25% of patients as compared to many years ago, as I told you, we probably get about 5% 5 year survival. So this is a remarkable improvement. And we also have reports that patients that are put on immunotherapy actually has complete responses that hasn't come back even beyond the 5 years. So we know that we are still waiting for results, but you know it seems that some of these patients may potentially be cured by this new class of agents that actually harnesses the immune system to attack the cancer itself. So I mean, we can't confidently say that this is a cure, but potentially with immunotherapy and possibly with a combination of other treatment modality like radiation or even surgery on others, we may be able to actually cure even advanced stages. So it's exciting times. So I think there's still a lot of trials that are ongoing and all that. I think the future is looking very bright indeed.
So would all stage four patients be suitable for immunotherapy?
Okay, the answer is yes, but again, when we do about lung cancer, even cancer, solid cancers or cancer nowadays, is that we don't just look at one treatment or the cancer. This is lung cancer, therefore it's treated that way. What we want to know is the driver or the mutations that actually make this cancer multiply and metastasize, etc. So what we want to do is to test the cancer for all these mutations, different mutations. So for lung cancer in particular, very importantly, is specific mutation or so-called driver mutations actually makes the cancer grow. So one of the very important one is called EGFR mutation, which is very common in our Asian population. About 30-40% of our lung cancer patients, especially the non-smokers, develop lung cancer. They actually have this mutation. And if they have this mutation, we will not use immunotherapy, but we use a specific targeted drug taken orally, because we know that this is actually, this will work very well, even better than immunotherapy. So we actually use this and not immunotherapy. And there are other mutations available like ROS1, ALK, etc. We will still use all this targeted drug and not immunotherapy. But in those patients without all these so-called driver mutations, that's when immunotherapy will come in, and often in combination with chemotherapy. And of course, unless they have this particular signal in the cancer, we call it a PD-L1 expression. If they have very high expression, we actually will give them immunotherapy alone, and they just work remarkably well if they have that particular signal in the cancer.
I see. You know, I think a lot of the misconceptions or a lot of the fears about cancer treatment is related to the side effects of chemotherapy. So with immunotherapy, would you expect to see the same kinds of side effects? And, you know, if you can give an advanced stage patient 5 or more years when before there was, you know, not even a hope of a cure, are these extra years actually quality years as well?
Oh, yes. So, okay. So if we provide a treatment and we can't improve the quality of life of the patient, then it will be very futile, especially in patients who have advanced disease, and you know that, you know, their days are, you know, going to be, you know, numbers in a way, correct? So the remaining days are very important. So if we give a treatment that doesn't maintain their quality of life, then there's no point having a very long survival, but every day the patient is suffering. Mm-hmm. So the good news about all these new targeted drugs or immunotherapy is that the side effects are much lesser and much easier to manage. So the patient's quality of lives are much better compared to chemotherapy. So it's not that they have no side effects, but these side effects are much easier to manage. And oftentimes it doesn't affect, they don't have life-threatening side effects like chemotherapy, which potentially we know that can cause myelosuppression, i.e. the blood count can drop, they can lead to immunosuppression, and patients can actually die from it. Whereas with targeted drugs and immunotherapy, the side effects is much, much less. So mm-hmm. I would say that not just improving the survival, but hopefully all these drugs has been shown to improve the quality of life as well.
All right. But of course, with advanced treatments comes a higher cost as well. What can be done to improve patients' access to these treatments?
I think this is a big problem, not just for Malaysia, but I think it's for everywhere in the world. Malaysia especially, we know that your population, a sizable population, are still in the probably lower middle class, or even can't really afford all this very expensive medication. So I think it's a big problem. It's not just in Malaysia. I think the main problem is that besides getting access to all these drugs, is that even coming to a proper diagnosis and early diagnosis and prevention, I think that is also called to a lot of challenge already. So I think it's a way to improve the access to this drug is that unless we can come up with some comprehensive insurance policy, and really it's beyond what I can think of and how to answer this. I think it's really come to, it's going to be a very challenging and difficult thing. So I think it really leaves to our politicians and other policymakers to really come down to how do we, distribute this very important treatment to so that everyone will benefit from it. I think it's going to be a big challenge.
And you're absolutely right. Actually, the cheapest form of prevention is something we're not availing ourselves of,
absolutely,
just to not smoke or to quit smoking and to go for early screening. And speaking of smoking, Dr. John, how much can smokers reduce their risk of lung cancer when they quit smoking? Does it matter how long they had been smoking previously?
Yeah, it does matter because the length of that they are on the carcinogen and all this exposure, it's important. The number of pack or cigarettes that you smoke every day is important. So it's the longer they are on it, then when they stop smoking, it will take a longer time when their risk profile will actually diminish and to be the same as the general population. So it will take many, many years. So it will not be that I stop smoking today, I'm a heavy smoker, then my risk will go back to a normal level, just like a person of the same age as me who doesn't smoke for his entire life. So it will take time, but every minute counts. The sooner you stop smoking, you will lower your risk.
Absolutely. I also want to very quickly look at the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, Dr. John, and one of the unintended consequences of the pandemic and the lockdowns was delays in things like cancer screening, diagnosis, and some treatment services. So from your perspective, how did the MCO affect cancer patients?
I think definitely this pandemic is a great challenge for the whole healthcare providers and for patients especially. There's this inherent fear of coming to the hospital, worried about being infected with the virus. But I'm fortunate in a way because most of our patients still manage to actually continue their treatment without breaks. And we know that it's very important for patients with advanced stage lung cancer and cancer in general to actually continue their treatment, because if they stop the treatment, the disease will progress and this will lead to a lot of problems and also probably shorten the survival. So I'm fortunate that my patients in the Klang Valley and also the local patients, we managed to actually carry on our treatment without much problem in this pandemic. But what I face mainly the problem is my patients from overseas, in a short period of time or so from Sabah and Sarawak, but mainly from overseas, from Indonesia especially, mm-hmm. and further, they just couldn't travel here. So mm-hmm. what we have tried to do to help them is to actually have some, sometimes even teleconference with them, and try to actually direct them to their local oncologists to carry on the treatment over there. So I think overall, majority of them still manage to carry on their treatment. It does kind of cause a lot of initial panic, and everyone is just worried that what to do, and mm-hmm. especially all these travel bans and all that. So I think very importantly to get the message across to the audiences, I mean the listeners, that despite this COVID and all that, when you have cancer, advanced disease, you should never stop treatment. There mm-hmm. will be a solution. Even your doctor is further away and all that, there will always be somewhere you can receive the proper treatment and care.
What about screening though? I imagine that is something that some people may more easily put off. It's okay, I'll just wait this out and go, a few months' time. Would that have any significant impact on diagnosis?
Definitely, yeah, it would. And there are some indicators that and also studies, recent studies that have been presented, that there are some cases that are presenting at a later stage because of this pandemic, because of patients trying to delay coming to the hospital for checkups and trying to avoid coming to the hospital. One thing to tell the listeners again is that all the hospitals in Malaysia and even everywhere else in the world is that we take very seriously the screening for COVID-19. Everyone, we screen them thoroughly, taking their temperature, jotting down their contact and travel history, as well as actively screening for patients with COVID-19 if they are at risk. And also the hospital is actively disinfecting the place, and also make sure that every place is clean and COVID-19 free, so called. Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually, if you think about it, the hospital may be actually a very safest place, in fact, because of all this active screening.
Certainly safer than many other public places where you see a lot of complacency setting in already.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Dr. John, do you want to leave us with a final message for World Lung Cancer Day?
Well, I think the main thing, as we have discussed, I think the main thing is to prevent the disease. So we know that smoking is the number one cause. So I think we should try our best to stop smoking if you are a smoker, and don't start smoking if we do not smoke. I think that is my main message to the public, because this is the number one cause of lung cancer, and lung cancer is one of the number one killer in Malaysia. And I also like to tell the public to, if they have any symptoms and all that, to go forward for screening and to see their doctors and don't ignore their symptoms.
Thank you so much, Dr. John. I've been speaking to consultant oncologist Dr. John Lau about lung cancer. And you've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.